This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.
I've got a job to do and I can't give up and say, well, reform is doing all right, so I'm just not going to do anything.
We are now the opposition to the Labour government, and I think the Tories' days, frankly, are numbered.
We haven't done slogans. These are structural problems that we've had in our economy and in our society for a long time, and therefore turning it around does take a little bit more than 7 months.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. Well, hello. It's a big day at Westminster, Kieran, and I'd like to wish you a happy 100 days of Kemi Badenoch, if you celebrate. To mark the occasion, the new Conservative leader, did an extended interview, a podcast interview, and she's doing another later today, despite her hatred of doing the media. But it must be said that the verdict on her first 100 days as Conservative leader is mixed at best. Now, you and some of our Guardian colleagues, Kieran, have written a great piece today about Kemi Badenoch's first 100 days in power. What was the general view from those you spoke to? Did they think it was a total failure or disappointing, or is there something salvageable? I should say that one line which really stood out to me was a quote from a Tory insider saying there's a 40% chance that the Conservative Party doesn't survive. I mean, that's existential, isn't it?
Yeah, well, first of all, happy 100 days. I celebrate so much, in fact, that I've taken the whole of this week off and I'm sitting here on my day off just to mark the occasion properly.
Some would say that's pretty sad. Others would say, look, how wonderfully committed you are.
I just love our listeners. I love our listeners so much. We've done about 4 or 5 podcasts in the last week. So I'm glad to be back here and back in the broom
in your
cupboard.
Shorts and t-shirt.
Yeah, I know. I'm
it
sorry.
Is. What is it outside?
It's 4 degrees.
Positively warm by recent standards.
I was considering going for a run later, but I think I might just go to the gym instead and stay indoors. Anyway, Kemi Badenoch, you were asking what is the general view. We wrote that piece because it is 100 days, but we've actually been gathering information and quotes and intelligence for it for several weeks now. And it has really struck me over the last few weeks that every single Tory MP I speak to, and that includes shadow ministers, is utterly downbeat and depressed about the state of the party and, I should say, Kemi Badenoch's leadership. There is not a single person that I have met who has given me a kind of positive, favourable view of how it's all going, which is surprising, not least because, Labour's not in a very good position. So usually, if nothing else, if your main opponents are struggling, then, you know, there'll be a bit of pep in your step. But that is not the case on the Tory benches right now. And some of the quotes that we were getting over the last couple of weeks, a veteran backbencher I spoke to, who's seen quite a few leaders, said the problem with Kemi Badenoch is she applied for one job, but she actually got another. Mm. She thought she was applying to be head of a centre-right Tory think tank, but actually she's supposed to be leader of the opposition, and they are different jobs. This person also said, this person is quite fond of metaphors, I should say. This person said she wants to be an architect, but the job of being leader of the opposition is actually to be a bricklayer. It's just graft. It's turning up to the fundraisers, to the meetings, to the kind of, you know, the rubber chicken circuit, as we call it, the constituency association dinners, where you eat overcooked chicken that tastes like rubber. And she just doesn't do a lot of that. And she thinks she can do things differently. But actually what you realize, especially when your party doesn't have that many seats and is fighting for attention, is that you actually have to do the hard yards and get out there and do the media appearances and do the fundraising dinners and do all that stuff that she obviously doesn't like to do.
And of course, you can compare her with Keir Starmer when he first took over the Labour Party after their disastrous defeat in 2019. And they recognised quite quickly that you got very little attention when you were in opposition. So you had to use the attention you got wisely. You pick your battles because you weren't going to get the front pages every day, and that you needed to use the time to rebuild the party. And obviously Keir Starmer had several steps in that with him. It was detoxifying the party after the rise over anti-Semitism, and then it was the internal stuff, the membership rules, changing the rules. And then it was taking the fight to the Conservatives. And only then, just before the election, finally, was it setting out Labour's plan for government. And Kemi Badenoch had said that she wouldn't be setting out any policy, but she already actually has done a couple of things. The one sort of deliberate policy intervention was last week around migration, again, trying to kind of make the party look and sound tough on migration. But she has inadvertently made a couple of policy announcements as well much earlier on in her response to the budget, when she said she would reverse Labour's VAT increase on private schools, which would cost them £2 billion a year. And I think it's really interesting, and people in Downing Street keep banging on about this, that if Labour had done that in opposition and effectively announced policies which cost £2 billion a year, they'd be getting it in the neck about how they pay for it. And that hasn't happened, I suspect, because we're so soon after the general election and there's so long to go. But Kemi Badenoch has said that she recognises that the party needs to win back trust and sort of get a grip on what's going on internally. But so far, that's proven quite difficult. I mean, there's no money. Donations have dried up, and we've seen some big name donors going to the Reform Party. Our colleague Rowena Mason has written a lot about that. They are moving out of their headquarters in central London to try and find somewhere cheaper. You know, that is before they get to sort of, you know, winning back public trust, which has been so battered over there, 14 years in power, particularly towards the end. So it feels that she's got a very, very long way to go. But the biggest challenge she has, of course, is Nigel Farage's Reform Party.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the most interesting things that came up, again, even while I was talking to shadow ministers, this is not disgruntled backbenchers here. These are people who've just been given jobs by Kemi Badenoch, is they were talking openly about saving the Tory party by doing a deal with Reform. And albeit a lot of the people who talk about that are the more Reform-minded people, but they are essentially talking about a deal that could compromise the very existence of their party. And that's where, when you're saying this, it could be existential, that's exactly what people are talking about. What do you give away to do this deal with Reform if that's what you want to do? And I think that what Kemi Badenoch is finding, and what the Tory party is finding, is they thought that they were choosing somebody who, a bit similar to Nigel Farage, could capture attention and tap into portions of the electorate that mainstream, more, I guess, traditional politicians can't reach. But the problem is that Nigel Farage is so good at sucking that oxygen up and taking it away, mm-hmm. that Kemi Badenoch just isn't finding the space to do it. So, yes, multiple people I have spoken to in the last few weeks have said, we will at some point need to do a deal. Now, what a deal means varies a lot. Some people just say, well, it'd be a non-aggression pact where we agree not to fight them in certain constituencies. But at this point, you know, Reform would be demanding quite a lot of constituencies. Yeah. Some people say, no, we actually need to invite them into government. Well, what job is Nigel Farage going to expect if you do that? And what then is Kemi Badenoch's future if she does that? You know, how far are you willing to go? Bearing in mind as well that Nigel Farage is not somebody who's ever spoken, well, not in recent decades, has spoken warmly about the Tory party. In fact, he's spoken about destroying it. So do you really want to do a deal with this man?
So one idea that's being discussed is they call it the James the First model. Now, Scottish history buffs like me will know about this, but this was when in 1603, James the Sixth of Scotland managed to bring together those old enemies, England and Scotland, under one crown, and he became James the First of England and James the Sixth of Scotland. So this sort of potential merger or non-aggression pact or whatever it ends up being looked like has been talked about as being the James the First model.
And interestingly, of course, James the Sixth and the First being the leader of the smaller of the two countries.
Well,
there.
Yes, exactly. Yes, point which wasn't missed. So, if you ask both camps, they say no, that they would not want to work together in an official merger. And I think from the Conservative Party perspective, it's quite difficult because Kemi Badenoch has talked quite a lot about Nigel Farage wanting to destroy the Conservative Party. She took the fight to him over the summer over membership numbers, ended up in threats of legal action. And I think there was a feeling that if you were to go down this route, the Conservatives would need a leader that was maybe more acceptable to the idea of working with Reform, but also to Reform members and voters, like Robert Jenrick or Suella Braverman or someone like that. it could, of course, be politically toxic to huge numbers of Conservative voters and indeed some Conservative MPs. And from the Reform perspective, they would expect, you know, a clear out of CCHQ. I think Rupert Lowe, one of their MPs, has suggested that this idea would not be possible without that. And a clear out of what he described as their Lib Dem MPs, i.e. the ones who are perhaps at the more moderate end, the more centrist end of the spectrum. The options on discussion, as you said, there could be sort of tactical voting, unofficial pacts not stand against each other. Some, and I think these are like the real advocates of a merger, talk about replicating what happened in Canada when the Conservative Party there was wiped out in 1993 and the Reform Party, same name, basically took over and they became the main force on the right, and the suggestions that they could call themselves the Reformed Conservative Party. Now, I think under this leader in particular was some way off that. Mm-hmm. You know, we spoke to Jeremy Hunt last week in one of our special podcasts, and he, of course, reminded us of the view that exists in a big chunk of the Conservative Party still, that if you shift to the right, you lose the sort of the middle voters, the people that voted for somebody like him, and potentially you lose MPs like him, because there are voters right across the country who back Lib Dems or Greens at the last election, that faced with the spectre of Nigel Farage entering Downing Street, or at least getting a big job in government, would throw their weight behind Labour.
Can I just give the counter-argument to all of that for a minute, which is, I think that Westminster is still getting used to the fact that we are likely now to have a full four or five year parliament with Labour in charge with a large majority, and that politics is essentially much more stable than it has been for the last few years.
I think this side of the Atlantic.
Actually, yes, in the UK. But, you know, I think that especially in the Tory party, people have kind of become a bit addicted to the drama and so used to these, you know, almost biannual bouts of regicide where they get rid of somebody and bring somebody else in and hope that that turns their fortunes round. They're just not used to having this kind of long period where they can do what Kemi Badenoch is suggesting, which is take some time, get the policies right, choose your moments, choose your battles, and not really have to be heard until 2-3 years down the line. Now, whether the Tory party has the patience for that or not, I don't know. But I don't think it's a completely ridiculous strategy. I do think there is time for them to come back. And Kemi Badenoch is still an immensely effective communicator. You know, there's talents that won her the leadership contest. She still has them. Mm-hmm. The question is, you know, can she manage to hold the wolves from the door for long enough to actually get that hearing? And that would be really interesting to watch over the next couple of years.
And it's not just the Conservatives that are thinking about Reform UK at the moment. The government today is carrying out a publicity blitz as it attempts to show voters it's serious about clamping down on illegal migration. And Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, is to take part in dawn raids, with Labour also publishing video footage of deportations. Now, tackling immigration is a sensitive issue for many in the Labour Party, but there's a feeling, not just on the backbenches, but within government as well, that as Reform UK is not showing any signs of slowing down in their rise in the polls, that they need to take the fight directly to them. I was working yesterday while you were off. I don't know what you were doing yesterday, Kieran, having fun somewhere probably.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, with a 4 and a 7-year-old.
Sounds brilliant.
Watching football in the local park.
That sounds
9 o'clock in the morning.
Perfect. Anyway, while you were off doing that, being a good dad, I was behind my desk writing up Labour's immigration announcement. And I spoke to various people in government, one of whom in Downing Street said to me, it's not just about taking the fight to Reform and challenging them on political territory, which is very powerful for them, migration. It's actually because they've got quite a good story to tell on irregular migration, they think. But it's just that people don't believe it. So they've got all these facts and figures, but people say to them in their focus groups, it can't be true because they've not seen it on the telly. So I think that's what a lot of this push, this publicity blitz is about. It's about convincing people that actually they are taking action. And I think it's interesting that they're cracking down on people who are working illegally here, because I know from conversations I've had in recent weeks with diplomats and politicians from European member states that one of their big frustrations with the UK is that we are seen, they say, as a soft touch when it comes to cracking down on our black market economy, so that we have people working, you know, in car washes and nail bars and restaurants and warehouses and all the rest of it, who aren't, don't the documentation to work here illegally, and they're not pursued and employers aren't pursued. So when people are traveling to the UK, or indeed making a decision to stay here once their legal status has expired, they think, well, I can get a job. Nobody's going to kick me out. So it is a problem. And the government is trying to step up its action. I have to say, even though they're saying that raids are up almost 50% with enforcement teams descending on a whole variety of premises, and that there's been a 73% rise in arrests in January, that is only up from about 350 last year to 600 this year. And they talk about how more than 16,400 failed asylum seekers, irregular immigrants and foreign criminals have been deported since the election. But they don't say that more than half of those left the country voluntarily. While, of course, they can tell their good story, as they put it, you probably get reform saying you need to go much, much further.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, I wrote a story last week about a new set of ads that Labour are trialling on Facebook, which they're branded as being not from Labour, but from UK Migration Updates. They've got breaking news over the top. And then the headline is deportations hit a 5-year high. And they're all coloured in a very familiar shade of turquoise blue.
And whose colour is that?
Looks quite similar to Reform UK, I would suggest. We wrote it up as Reform style adverts. And yeah. Nobody in Labour pushed back on that idea. They are Reform style adverts. They've got another set of Facebook adverts, which were about crime and antisocial behaviour, which were all branded with Union Jacks. And again, don't really mention the Labour Party at all. This is clearly a tactic. And it has, as you mentioned, upset some in the Labour benches, because there is, of course, an argument that no matter whether what you're doing is the right thing or the wrong thing, although that, of course, that's important, but just playing on Reform's territory in this way is likely to damage you. What you're essentially saying is, hey, look, Nigel Farage is right about one of the biggest issues that you care about, therefore vote Labour. And it's been shown time and time again that doesn't work for the Conservative Party. So that's what some in Labour are worried about. I mean, it's a really interesting moment, actually, for the Labour Party right now. We're heading into these local elections, and there are lots of MPs, not just in the Red Wall, but down south as well, who have Reform as either number two in their constituencies or at least a competitive number three, who are starting to warn Party HQ and Number 10 that they're feeling nervous, and they don't think, as you were saying earlier, there's any let up in that surge of support for Reform, and that their seats are essentially at risk. So you've also seen this establishment of a new group of Labour MPs who've all got Reform as number two in their constituencies, who are sharing tips, sharing campaign tips and polling and discussing what works and having discussions with Number 10 and talking more about migration. But also a group of them are going to Germany to learn about the rise of Alternative for Deutschland, AfD, the far-right party over there. This is something that is really consuming a lot of Labour attention right now, as almost as much as it is on the Tory benches.
Yeah, and all the polling suggests that migration is up there with the economy and the NHS as the three key issues that voters care about. And the government believes that Donald Trump won his election because of the economy and migration. They say that they won. I mean, there are lots of reasons why they won, but they believe that the key issues were economy and migration. I'd added NHS into that. So they are conscious that they do need to take action rather than just sounding tough. You're right, though, that some in the party are queasy. I mean, I spoke to Diane Abbott yesterday, the Labour veteran MP, who was a former Shadow Home Secretary herself under Jeremy Corbyn, who said that really she thought that the only outcome of sort of trying to be reform light for Labour would be that you drive people to vote for the real deal and that people would vote for Farage instead. She obviously represents an inner city London seat with a huge Labour majority. So she's possibly talking from a position of comfort on there, that some of her more anxious colleagues in parts of what we call the Red Wall don't share. But it's also something that's been picked up at the top of government. And there was a big 6-hour cabinet away day at Lancaster House in central London last week, where Keir Starmer told his ministers, and didn't just tell them, but it was briefed out to us, that progressive liberals have been too relaxed about not listening to people about the impact of it. And I think the reality is that many people do feel an impact of migration. And whether that is something which is inflamed by the right, I think is an argument that they blame a lot of, you know, what is wrong with the country on immigration, which actually, you know, the problems exist elsewhere, like, you know, years of austerity under the Tories and mismanagement of particular parts of the public sector. You know, there are lots of reasons, the economic backdrop being another. Nevertheless, it does have purchase with people, those arguments. And I think what this government has learnt is a head versus heart thing. And we learned it with Brexit. We learned it with the rise of reform, is that what matters often is how voters feel rather than, you know, the arguments they're told, the numbers and facts and figures they're presented with. And voters feel that migration is an issue. So whether it is as much of an issue as many people believe is kind of a moot point politically. Plenty of people in Labour that think the government should be making the argument for legal migration and boosting numbers in areas where there's skills shortages, helping grow the economy. But when it comes to irregular migration, the government has clearly decided that they need to not just talk the talk, but also walk the walk.
I'd just say two things on that. First of all, I would say this isn't just heart. Immigration as an issue dropped in salience after Brexit. And in fact, you know, one of the arguments that some pro-Brexiters used was for Brexit was, well, immigration won't be as much of an issue afterwards because we'll have punctured that bubble. And that did seem to have happened. It's come back up the agenda, not just because of people how people feel, I think, but because of genuine changes in migration behaviour and patterns. And what we had after Brexit, with a lot of EU workers not being able to do certain jobs anymore, we had to bring in migrants from other places in the world. And I think people have noticed that, and people do feel the impact of that. I mean, it is not a coincidence that we've had record net migration. This is legal migration, net migration numbers, and migration has gone up in terms of, you know, the issues that people care about. There is something happening and people are noticing. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'd say in terms of Labour's response, I had a very interesting conversation with Jonathan Ashworth last week, who is head of former MP, who lost his seat at the last election and is now head of the Labour think tank, Labour Together. He's turning his attention now to this anti-reform strategy. And he's thinking quite a lot about and doing focus groups about what works and what doesn't against Nigel Farage. One thing he said to me is, go after him on the NHS. So Nigel Farage has in the past talked about having a kind of health insurance based system that is not necessarily free at the point of use. And Labour thinks this is a real weak spot that they can hammer him over. So it came up at PMQs last week. I would expect it to come up a lot in the run up to the local elections. So let's see if that message works better than their kind of crackdown on illegal migration. It'd be interesting to know which of those resonates more with voters.
So there's a few other things that we're keeping our eyes on this week. One is that Andrew Gwynne, the junior health minister, has been sacked after it was revealed he sent racist and sexist messages in a WhatsApp group chat with other local politicians in Tameside in Greater Manchester. And he's the third minister to leave government since November, coming after, of course, the Transport Secretary Lou Hague and the Economic Secretary to the Treasury, Tulip Sadiq. How much of it is a problem, Kieran, is it that he's the third minister out the door in such a short period of time?
Well, is it a short period of time? I need to look at that chart again. There's a famous chart that goes around at moments like this where you track the number of ministerial resignations over time. And you see, I think, you know, the one showing Boris Johnson's ministerial resignations just rockets up. I think last time I checked, we're broadly tracking historical trends.
What does feel different, though, is that Keir Starmer is not beating around the bush. He's cracking on and getting rid of people who have, you know, committed these various transgressions. The news that Andrew Gwynne was being sacked came before the Mail on Sunday story about why he was being sacked. Yeah. So, you know, he's being pretty ruthless when he needs to be. And he's made a lot of standards in public life, and he's obviously recognises the importance of, you know, sticking to some of his promises and all of that. But it's another Monday morning also of Donald Trump sending global economies into a minor cardiac arrest. This time, yet another sort of unguarded comment on the way to the Super Bowl. He threatened 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminium to the US. And it is an industry which has great domestic symbolism, but is under huge pressure as well, with major questions questions about whether it could survive even before you get to the point of tariffs. One thing I immediately thought of is in my conversations with David Lammy last week, you remember I was travelling to Ukraine with him. I asked him about whether the UK should retaliate against the US if Donald Trump did impose trade tariffs. And his answer was really interesting. He said, it's a cross-party position that we're an open free market society that doesn't believe in tariffs in either direction. Mm. Now, that against the backdrop of ministers who had been hoping that the UK might be less of a target given it runs a trade deficit with the US. I think we're going to have to keep a close eye on what happens with steel.
Yeah, well, the signs that we've been getting, I mean, you got most openly from David Lammy there, is that the UK will not retaliate with tariffs of their own. Last time, of course, we did retaliate. We retaliated particularly with goods that come from Republican states and Levi jeans and motorcycles.
Harley Davidsons.
Bourbon
as well.
Bourbon whiskey. Yeah. I mean, this time around, I don't know, it feels different. And, you know, if we were to retaliate, it would jar quite a lot with the tone that's been coming out in recent weeks, which has all been, you know, very softly, let's cozy up to Trump. But, you know, if it doesn't work, if he still goes ahead and hits us with 25% steel and aluminium tariffs, then I guess maybe the government approach has to change.
Yeah, maybe they won't pull the punches so much. It's all in the hands at the moment of our new ambassador in Washington, one Lord Peter Mandelson, who begins his job this week. Fortunately, he's a trade expert, so hopefully he'll manage to at least find out what's going on.
Maybe he'll tell Donald Trump to F off like he did to our colleagues at the FT last week.
I suspect that will not be the tactic he'll be taking. But thanks to all of you for listening and for getting in touch with your thoughts and questions. Please do keep them coming in. You can email us at politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com or leave a comment wherever you're listening. And if you're enjoying listening to Politics Weekly, please do like and follow the podcast.
And recess is next week, of course, so we won't be here, but we will be back along with the MPs in Westminster the following Monday.
This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Zoe Hitch. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love The Audio Long Read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism with episodes about everything from the rise of ADHD to the double life of an alleged Russian spy. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow The Audio Long Read wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love The Audio Long Read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism with episodes about everything from the rise of ADHD to the double life of an alleged Russian spy. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow The Audio Long Read wherever you get your podcasts.